Welcome to Oncology Nursing Update, optimizing the care of patients with newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with nurse practitioner Ms. Charlize Gleason from Emory Healthcare in Atlanta. To begin our discussion, I asked her to reflect on how the care of patients with multiple myeloma has evolved during her career.
I was initially a hematology nurse, and so 26 years ago, we were admitting myeloma patients to give them VAD, and there weren't a lot of options. It was VAD, and then they went to transplant. I became a nurse practitioner in 2003, and that's really as new treatments started to develop at that time. But, you know, at that point, we were talking to patients about a 3 to 5 year life expectancy. And so we don't even have that conversation any longer, because with our newer drugs, and especially for a standard risk patient, their life expectancy is so long. And we're seeing patients in our practice that are 20 years out, 25 years out. So it looks very different. And the shift from the hospital to the ambulatory clinic and infusion center really is where the majority of your treatments are.
You know, historically, up to a quarter of our audience has been in oncology less than 5 years, so they really don't have that perspective. The other thing I think was, I feel like people kind of were sicker, were having more morbidity from the disease, more bone problems 20 years ago. Was that the case?
It totally was the case. And you would also see that at relapse, where with bone agents now, we get those started right at diagnosis along with induction therapy, and throughout the course of their myeloma when they relapse, you'll restart them again. So you don't see as many bone fractures. You might still see them at diagnosis, but not as many in that relapse setting.
Of course, you know, working at Emory, particularly with Sagar Loniel, who's, you know, a medical oncologist, been a real leader in the field. We've been working with him more than 15 years. You were part, really, initially in trials of the real revolution that occurred, I guess, in the early 2000s with novel agents, in particular, the regimen that everybody kind of came to and end up using pretty quickly, which is RVD. And, of course, Sagar and Emory were a big part of that, as a number of other places. Do you remember how things evolved when RVD got introduced and what you were seeing as you started to treat people with that? And maybe explain a little bit about what it is.
Yeah. We initially used bortezomib and then lenalidomide separately on clinical trials. But with early data, when you started combining treatment, we went to that RVD regimen early. And so that's lenalidomide, which is oral, bortezomib, which at the time was IV and now is subcutaneous, and then dexamethasone. And that triplet really changed things in the landscape for myeloma patients. And we started at a time when people were still giving single agent or doublets at that point. And, you know, patients would come in twice a weekly for bortezomib. The lenalidomide was days 1 through 14, and then dexamethasone was a twice weekly dose at that point. And so you really had to monitor patients, get them through the first cycle, I would think was the most challenging at that point. It was just different. But the dexamethasone dosing was different as well. It got us away from that 40 milligrams, 4 days on, 4 days off, which patients didn't like, but still a lot of dexamethasone. A lot of centers now give the bortezomib weekly. We're still a center that we'll start it off twice weekly, but watching neuropathy closely and knowing that we can go down to weekly on that. So it's been a really good regimen and really changed the lives of myeloma patients.
So before we go on, maybe just because, you know, proteasome inhibitors like bortezomib and IMiDs, or specifically lenalidomide, we have some new CELMoDs coming along, are still a big part of treatment. Anything you want to say about particularly the tolerability issues that you see with these two types of agents, and particularly bortezomib and lenalidomide?
Lenalidomide, I think, is very well tolerated. It's, you know, does cause fatigue. It's myelosuppressive, so you do give the patients a week off to allow their counts to come back. Bortezomib, it's really neuropathy that you're monitoring for. And so in the early days when we gave it IV, we learned quickly that it could cause very painful neuropathy for our patients. It's much better now because they receive it subcutaneous, but you still have to watch. And even if you're not seeing neuropathy, if, for instance, they're going through transplant, so that stem cell collection and then transplant, a lot of times that's when that neuropathy can can really kick in at that time. So it's still something we have to be very careful with, but it's a really good combination and patients tolerate it very well.
So, you know, we were kind of reminiscing back to being at the ONS Congress where you've joined us in the past. We were in Denver this year. We did 11 programs. And there, you know, when we are doing all these things at once, you know, we maybe do three programs in a day on different tumors. And we had a lot of people going to this, you know, to multiple programs, and we would refer back to other programs. And I was just thinking about one of the themes that in oncology in general that we always got into and always continue to get into, it's really a huge issue in oncology, is first-line systemic treatment of patients with, I'm going to say, widespread disease. Because in solid tumors, that generally means, you know, metastatic disease as opposed to locally where you can treat localized. But in a lot of hematologic cancers like the lymphomas and myeloma, it's just assumed to be systemic. And so they're getting the same thing, first-line therapy for widespread disease. And how, when you look across oncology in terms of that, how it's, again, globally, how it's changed. And one of the things we always talk about almost every single program we do at ONS, and we did this year, is how now clinical biomarkers are entering into the, you know, the treatment of patients in general, including myeloma, for example, and breast cancer. What kind of treatment you're going to get is depending upon your estrogen receptor status, your HER2 status, many other things, colon cancer, your KRAS status. So, you know, measurements of different types of, you know, assays of the tumor itself so that treatment can be individualized. And every one of these cancers has their own sort of thing. So, we see all different kinds of approaches. Urothelial, we see antibody drug conjugates now in solid tumors and hematologic cancers being used first line. Breast cancer was just a big presentation at ASCO on that. Diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, we have an antibody drug conjugate with chemotherapy. So each one has their own flavor. But I guess a couple things about myeloma have always been different. And one is that they have this kind of, I mean, I'm just saying from my point of view, because we teach all parts of oncology, a very different approach to the younger patient than older patient. And it really revolves around the use of one of the older, you already referred to it, that was happening when you first started treatments, which is high-dose chemotherapy with autologous stem cell rescue, which continues to be used in patients who are able to tolerate it. And then with patients either who have comorbidities or they're older with comorbidities, they go down sort of another route. And it kind of seems like that continues to the present time, and really the big issue is whether they're going to get transplanted. After transplant, people usually get some kind of maintenance therapy, maybe indefinitely, like lenalidomide, for example. But any thoughts about how you think, you know that you have a patient who's got active myeloma that you and your team are going to be looking at in clinic that day. What are some of the things that you're thinking about as a regard, what are some of the individual characteristics of the patient's tumor and their functional status that are going to kind of lead you in certain directions of treatment?
No, that's a good question. And this is with newer treatments, what's changed for us. So the first thing you're going to look at with a new patient is, are they transplant eligible or not? And that's going to take you down the road of the treatment selection. Though having said that, what we do know about those patients who aren't going to go to transplant, they still do well with the multi-drug regimen. So you just give them less of a dose or a little modified on that. And in the other pieces, we risk stratify based on high-risk, standard-risk disease. So you're looking at those abnormal cytogenetics, those FISH abnormalities. That really helps guide us on our treatment. So knowing that, you know, we're going to give, you know, a transplant-eligible patient is going to get a four-drug regimen, whether you're standard risk or high risk. You're transplant-ineligible, we're still going to treat that same. We're going to give them a multi-drug regimen, just a little gentler. And then where that risk stratification really comes in is in that maintenance setting. So your patient who's not going to transplant, they're going to continue on their treatment. And it, depending on the risk factors associated with it, whether you can stop one or two of the drugs and go to a single agent maintenance later on or not, is really going to make that decision at that point.
And it is very standard to look at these patients with myeloma to see, particularly looking for 17p deletion and p53 status as the highest risk. But of course, there are others in terms of the plan there. Another thing that's kind of come along that I think people hear a lot about, and particularly in trial, clinical trials and in research centers like yours, and more I'm hearing this in the community, sort of a concept that has evolved over the last few years is what's called minimal residual disease. So an assay that'll kind of go subclinical, almost kind of like a tumor marker in a way, to detect the evidence of myeloma at very, very low levels. And when they're, quote, MRD negative, much different prognosis. Any thoughts about how that's affected taking care of patients in this first-line situation and how patients respond when they start seeing these MRD assays?
Yeah. You know, this is why we do four drugs up front, right, for a transplant-eligible patient, because we know that if you give them that anti-CD8-30 antibody, so daratumumab or isatuximab, we know that we drive a deeper response. You know, in the old days, like we were talking about, we used to hang back on drugs. We didn't want to give everything up front because you needed it for someday. That's not the case anymore. You want to give our patients the benefit of the best treatment up front because you want to drive that response down deeper into the microenvironment. So when you're looking at minimal residual disease, you're looking at 1 in a million cells, which is pretty amazing. You know, we didn't have that technology before. We're looking at a bone marrow biopsy. And so patients now, we're still looking at the same things we used to look at. But now we get that MRD, looking at it after they've had induction therapy. And then whether or not they go to transplant, then we have that period of time that we look at it afterwards as well. And then annually on those patients. And it really tells us about the depth of their response. I think there's a lot more to learn from it. We still don't have a consensus on how we use it, but everybody in the myeloma community seems to agree now it's very important in how we look at our patients' response to therapy.
You know, it's funny when I sit down and chat with people, I sometimes get these little flashes of memory, and I don't know where they came, things I haven't thought about for years. And as you were just talking about MRD, I remember the first time I worked with your partner there, Sagar.
Yeah.
And at that time, he had pulled this picture of an iceberg out, and he would show it. I knew you would remember it, because that was the first time really I started to really think about what eventually became MRD, because you would show this picture and see how much ice was really under the water. And that's really the whole issue of subclinical disease. You mentioned the next big step that occurred in upfront treatment of myeloma was the evolution of anti-CD38 antibodies that you just talked about, daratumumab and isatuximab. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about your vision about and how you explain to patients what these antibodies are, why they're effective, and how it gets integrated? And, you know, it's also used in relapse disease, but now more and more as a standard up front. What do you say to patients about what these are and how much they add? To me, it was really one of the major steps forward in the field.
No, I agree. You know, I think, you know, myself as a nurse practitioner, and then our nursing team, you know, reinforces the education on this. We talk about the synergy that you get with these drugs. There's a reason we pair drugs together. And, you know, with the difference in that monoclonal antibody that really attaches to that plasma cell in a different way, it's the multiple ways that we, you know, cause cell death in that myeloma cell. It's very well tolerated for patients. As a matter of fact, patients are very sad when they have to come off of it, you know, due to progression. But, you know, especially since, you know, we tend to use daratumumab more, and we participated in the clinical trials, both monotherapy and in combination. And, you know, when we went to subcutaneous, it's just so well tolerated and, you know, really very few side effects. Patients do well with it.
Yeah, that really was a huge moment in myeloma. And, you know, of course, and again, we always talk about this in ONS, that particularly in the upfront setting where there are a lot of patients, people look to what's called phase 3 trials, to, you know, where they compare the standard of care versus the experimental. And there are a whole bunch of trials using, often it was RVD, because, I mean, that really became, or, you know, some variation of that, to that same therapy, or might have been RD, but whatever, novel therapy, plus or without anti-CD38. Mm-hmm. And they immediately started to see, you know, huge benefits without a whole lot of, you know, serious toxicity. Some things that we'll talk about. But I think one of the things that was really interesting, again, thinking about all across oncology, I don't think there was a meeting we did this year of the 11 we did at ONS where we didn't get into the issue of having multiple similarly acting agents within the same treatment class. It happens. Mm-hmm. There are different proteasome inhibitors. There's carfilzomib, yes, for example. You know, in breast cancer, the classic example was letrozole and anastrozole. Nobody could tell. They never were compared, but they looked identical. And, you know, there are all kinds of variations. You know, again, breast cancer, 3 CDK inhibitors to choose from, and right, on and on, you know, EGFR, lung cancer, et cetera. But, you know, I can't think of another situation where you had many times in oncology, you'll see trials indirectly. They seem to have similar benefit. I mean, you're not comparing them directly, but, you know, they're both compared against the same thing. They reduce the chance of recurrence by maybe 50% or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And then you try to figure out which one are you going to give. Maybe there's a little bit difference in the toxicity, so hard to decide often. But the thing that happened to myeloma that was so interesting was that one of them, that you have these two drugs that if you actually look at the trials, I mean, I think it was very difficult to separate either the efficacy or tolerability. I mean, maybe there is, but I've never really heard anybody say that. But the thing that was interesting was that one got a sub-Q formulation before the other one did, which is daratumumab. And of course, everybody flipped over to that because that's so much more patient-friendly. And you can talk about the difference between what you saw when it switched to sub-Q. And so really, I think now we're in a situation where almost every patient's getting an anti-CD38 antibody up front. What you pair it with, maybe that varies a little bit, but it's pretty standard, younger, older. Mm-hmm. But you have the option of sub-Q. But now, as of the ASCO meeting that just happened, it looks like there's going to be sub-Q for isatuximab, and it actually is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be an on-body device instead of having to be given by infusion. I don't even know. Have you ever used that, incidentally? I rarely find people who've even tried it.
The on-body device?
Yeah.
No, I've not, but I've seen it, and I've been in some talks and that where they've presented that. So that's going to be interesting.
Right.
You know, the right thing with subcutaneous for patients, you know, cancer, whatever type of cancer you have, patients want to gain some control back, right? They don't want to spend a lot of time in the infusion center. The more time they have doing what they want to do, the better. And so the subcutaneous formulations really help patients not have to spend as much time in that infusion chair so they can come in, they can get their treatment, and they can go. And I think in it being very well tolerated is just, it makes it so much easier for a patient.
Yeah, and I mean, again, not too many situations right now. Now we're starting to see the immune checkpoint inhibitors starting to become sub-Q. It'll be interesting to see how that affects, you know, what people do. And it seemed like, particularly specifically with daratumumab, that there was a lot less toxicity. It was the infusion was, well, the time and, you know, the infusion, sometimes the first one was very long, yeah, because they had toxicity. So it seemed like the patient experience was clearly better sub-Q. And it'll be interesting to see when this on-body thing, you know, comes on. I've talked to at least some docs who've used it in trial who think the nurses like it a lot. They think maybe it mm-hmm. could someday maybe be self-administered. You know, I don't know whether that's feasible or not, but just so interesting how these different factors affect what treatment is, because you've been seeing great data with both of them. I don't know. It's hard to separate out. You have one that's a great trial and everybody talks about it, another right. one talk. But I mean, is that at your center, of course, you're one of the top centers in the world on myeloma. Do you think the perception is that these are two essentially identical, but don't right now the difference is the sub-Q?
I think so. I think they're very similar. You know, we used both on clinical trials. It's just daratumumab was approved first and then subcutaneous. So we just tend to use more of that at our center. But the data is really good for both of them.
And what do you say to a patient who's about to begin either one of these agents in terms mm-hmm. of tolerability issues that might come up or complications. And what have you actually observed?
Yes, with the subcutaneous, you know, we tell them there's a very low chance of having a reaction at that first dose. So that one, we do give pre-meds. After that, we don't need to. We talk about maybe some local site discomfort, or, you know, they can get some redness around it or some itching at that site. We talk about, you know, especially because it's in combination. So those other side effects because of the combination drugs, you know, when to reach out to us, the potential for infection issues. They're on prophylaxis drugs for an antiviral. You know, if they're on the with an IMID, they're on prophylaxis for DVT or PE. So all of those, you know, you put all of those things in place. It isn't just the myeloma drugs. It's the other things for prophylaxis. So, you know, you have patients that go from not taking much of anything to a lot of things now. So it's an adjustment for them. But you really try to tease out in the regimen which side effect they're getting. You don't dose reduce daratumumab, for instance. It's the dose that it is. And that's not usually the culprit when they're having side effects. It's other drugs like dexamethasone that you typically have to adjust. But it's getting them typically through the first cycle, and then they do really well after that. And I think it really helps too. They tend to see results quickly, right? And so when you can see that you're responding to your treatment, that really helps as well.
When you have patients who do go for transplant, how do you see them? You know, usually, again, they're usually better condition, although I'm curious what the oldest patient is that you've transplanted there. But how are they when they get back from transplant?
It's a mix. I think the oldest patient, one of our colleagues probably transplants patients, Dr. Nuka, that are a little bit older. But I think for Dr. Loniel and I think the oldest patient was probably 81. They tend to be younger, but, you know, you really look at their performance status. It's not so much their age. Many patients do quite well with transplant, more fatigue, and some people get a little more take more of a hit after it. That's a big dose of melphalan. If you're going to adjust anything on somebody that's, you know, an older patient that's still going to transplant, for instance, you might do a dose reduce of melphalan. So it's that alkylating agent. But for the most part, you know, patients bounce back pretty quickly. They tend to need a little more sleep than they used to, and a little more fatigue. But by 6 months, most people are back to their normal routine. And a lot of patients, it's even sooner, especially a younger patient. And a lot of patients want to go back to work and get back to their activities earlier. So we look for, you know, we do our first restaging for a standard risk patient after transplant around day 100. And for a high risk patient, we do that at day 60. So we can get that maintenance started at that time.
So just another issue just to sort of mention that kind of interesting in terms of upfront treatment, mm-hmm. which is the issue of smoldering myeloma, and in mm-hmm. particular, high-risk smoldering myeloma. And again, your center has been very instrumental in researching this. Can you explain a little bit about what smoldering myeloma is, what high-risk smoldering is? And now the evolution, again, of anti-CD38, particularly daratumumab, being used in these patients, which kind of surprised me. I think it was a fairly recent trial. They saw great benefits treating these people who always used to be observed.
That's true. Yes. So smoldering is, you know, they've got a higher protein, you know, than somebody with a monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance. So they come in with a little bit more disease burden, but then we further risk stratify. Are they high risk? Do they have a higher free light chain, for instance, that puts them in that higher risk category? And those are the only patients that you would consider treating at this point. And it is in the context of a clinical trial. And so we've had multiple trials, and we have used, we also had the daratumumab clinical trial where they got it for a period of time. And then there was a maintenance phase afterwards on that. We've also used lenalidomide on trial, on the ECOG trial. And right now, then we're also using iberdomide, which is one of the newer drugs that we're looking at, but still very well tolerated. And the thought behind that is, can you give a defined number cycles of treatment to try to keep these patients from converting to symptomatic myeloma. So they never have those organ-related side effects that would force us then to be more aggressive with their treatment. And so I think, you know, we've learned a lot from that and the benefit in that 2-year period. So most of your clinical trials now for high-risk smoldering are with a treatment for around that 2-year period of time. And that's based on the data that came out from the ECOG trial.
Well, I'm curious, do you actually plan or to use it or have used it?
You know, we're still using it for clinical trials, honestly. I think everybody hasn't agreed in our practice on that. We have not started giving it in the high-risk smoldering.
That's interesting.
At our center yet.
So another thing I'm kind of curious about is I'm sure one of the things patients who are about to start treatment first line for myeloma, one of the things that's most on their mind, of course, is what to expect from the future. And particularly, you know, how long they might live. Although, in a way, it's kind of interesting because, again, flashing back to Dr. Loniel, I can remember cases he would tell me about over the years of people who went from one trial to the other trial to they kept going on the newest treatment before it ever got used. So it's kind of hard to predict, you know, right now maybe they have a prognosis of X, but maybe by the time you get to X, there's going to be some agents out there which actually is how it seems to be occurring, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But right now, given what we know in terms of the follow-up to patients who've gotten what usually is anti-CD38 plus either RVD or, you know, some variation of that, roughly what are you expecting in terms of their overall survival if they're standard risk or if they're this high, much smaller group that's very high risk, in terms of their kind of average or median survival?
Yeah, a standard risk patient, for some of those patients, they may have their upfront therapy, go to transplant, and go on lenalidomide maintenance, and they may never progress again. I mean, we see that. The difference is it's hard to predict which patients because their standard risk. You know, we know with high risk patients, we have to be more aggressive, but we don't really give patients times. You know, we expect patients to live a very long time with their disease and it to be more of a chronic disease that they're taking a medication for. I think the difference is they're almost always on medication now. Years ago, you would give them a treatment and then they would be off of treatment. And then they would progress and you would go to a treatment again. And that's just not the case now. It's a myeloma world of continuous therapy.
And again, we've spent entire programs on this series, for example, on one of the most exciting developments in oncology in general, bispecific antibodies and CAR T therapy and other therapies, you know, all these newer approaches that I think are going to, you know, just like it always happens in oncology, you find a drug that works in people who have relapse disease, they're going to start studying it. So we've in upfront, so now we've got trials looking at all the things I just talked about upfront. Instead of going to transplant, going to CAR T, going to transplant and CAR T. So who knows what's going to happen, you know, 5 or 10 years from now. But I guess, let's just put it this way. It's not unusual to see somebody survive 10 years or more. Is that a reasonable thought?
I think that's totally reasonable, yes. I think a lot of myeloma patients, if you look at the median age of diagnosis, you know, in a practice like ours, we see all ages, but the median age is later in life, so in 60s. So a lot of patients will die from something other than their myeloma, because our treatments are just so good. But you're right. We move those treatments. We start them in that relapse refractory patient population. And then as we use them more, we start moving them up front. And that's exactly what we're doing with bispecific antibodies and CAR T therapies. So CAR T is already approved for first relapse. But we're looking at it in the upfront setting on clinical trials as well. And bispecifics, you know, are off the shelf, easy to use, and we're also looking at the combination of bispecifics, so two different targets, and how do we use those? So it's pretty exciting.
For sure. I was just reflecting back, too, though, on this issue of first-line therapy and widespread disease across oncology, and like the scenario you just described in a disease that looked a lot like maybe pancreatic cancer 20 years ago, but unfortunately, pancreatic, the discussion is not that much different than it was 15 or 20 years ago. But then there are pockets of oncology where you're just seeing explosions. And myeloma certainly is one of those. I want to get into your cases a little bit so we can sort of get into this issue that we always get into with ONS meetings, which is when we start getting into the reason we always talk about real patients is the theme of why was it different to take care of this patient than another patient in the same oncologic situation, but a different person. So different comorbidities, age, attitude, social support, you name it, all the things that, you know, beyond just the tumor. But before we kind of see how that plays out in some of your patients, just kind of curious in general, what are some of the things, again, that you're thinking to look at in a patient you know you're going to be seeing with first-line therapy? And also how you look at patients, let's say, you know, myeloma has always been a great leader in looking at older patients. You guys came up with the idea of very elderly, which I never heard before. But and how this thought process in your mind differs when you have a 70-year-old patient coming in compared to an 88-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're still going to look at their performance status. You're going to look at their other comorbidities and those side effects that they have from those things. So you're risk stratifying, but you're also looking at the patient in front of you. You're looking at the care system they have. Do they have a care partner? What is that social system like available for them? And so, you know, you look at that for these patients and you could have a 50-year-old patient that comes in that just doesn't have the things in place, for instance, to take them to a transplant. So you really need to look at the whole picture of the person who's in front of you. And so if I'm thinking about an older patient who we know is not a transplant candidate, there are really good treatment options for them. And as we said before, you're still going to give them the benefit of a multi-drug regimen. You're just going to do it in a lighter fashion.
So one other sort of generic issue about first-line therapy that I hear a lot from oncologists, and you kind of referred to it before earlier, is the issue of the corticosteroids that these patients end up receiving. And I think in a way, again, when I think across oncology and I think about steroids, the first place I think about is you guys. And you talked about the dosing, et cetera, and also particularly the issue of dosing in the very elderly. So I'm curious what kind of issues do you think about with people in, getting steroids, you know, the hyper syndrome that they may get, not being able to sleep, diabetic issues, what you see and how you kind of adjust dosing to that.
Definitely. And they might have that history of diabetes, right? So you want to dose steroids very carefully. They don't tolerate the higher doses. And while you do get that synergy, and we know that dexamethasone works well in our regimens, we definitely go to a lower dose version. It also makes them more at risk for infections. And so these are things that we have to monitor throughout. So we might still hit it with a little bit higher of a dose of steroid in cycle one, still nothing like we would do for a younger patient, just to get that response, but watching carefully and listening to their side effects and dialing it down quickly. And then eventually stopping it. You don't have to keep steroids going for the whole time that they're on their therapy.
What other sort of general thing I was going to ask you about in terms of, again, initial treatment, even longer term treatment? You talked about the issue of preventive anti-infectives. What about the issue of vaccinations? Do people with myeloma have normal responses to vaccinations?
They don't. And, you know, we did a lot of that work during COVID, looking at how are our patients responding to COVID vaccines. And our personal experience, what we learned is those patients that had good disease control that were on a single agent, something like lenalidomide, those are the patients who mounted a response to vaccines. So we know that that's an issue in our patients. So we still have them get a flu vaccine. We still make sure they're caught up on meningococcal, but we know that that response isn't going to be as good for them. So we want to make sure that those around them are vaccinated.
All right, let's get into your cases, beginning with this 80-year-old woman. When did you first see her?
This was about 3 years ago at that time. So she came in, increased fatigue, some pain and was anemic. And that's really the thing that drove her primary care provider to take another look, because it's not uncommon to be a little more fatigued at that age. And, you know, she was anemic and they had an abnormal protein. She didn't actually, even though she had some back pain, she didn't actually have lytic lesions, which is a little bit different, right? We think of everybody coming in having that bone disease. Her bone marrow was pretty full of disease, and she just was a little bit frail. She had that history of AFib and was already on apixaban, some hypertension that was well controlled, but she already had a baseline neuropathy too. So we really had to think about that for this particular patient, knowing that some of our treatments have that potential to cause neuropathy. So it's really looking at that patient and tailoring that treatment and knowing that this is going to have to be monitored closely. And I think that's the thing that we count on our infusion nurses to help us with as well, right? We see them at the start of a cycle, they go to the infusion center to get their treatment. So, you know, the nurses really play a big role in that.
What was her neuropathy from? Did she have diabetes?
She did have some diabetes, so it was well controlled. But, you know, we have patients that come in that will have a baseline neuropathy for different reasons. Hmm. And, you know, so it's just something that you have to keep in mind when you're treating them. So a patient like this who's not transplant eligible, and she wasn't, you still want to give her that benefit of a good regimen. And so, you know, we tend to go to a regimen with daratumumab, lenalidomide, and low-dose dexamethasone, leaving off the proteasome inhibitor, which was consistent with how the MAIA trial did it. And she responded beautifully to this. She tolerated it well. We did a lower dose of lenalidomide for her. She started at still a pretty decent dex dose at 20 milligrams, but then we reduced that as well. But she responded well, went into a complete response and MRD negative, which is the best case that you could get for the patient.
So in answer, you know, you mentioned here that the study really led to the treatment she got. The median progression-free survival is 64 months. That's more than 5 years. So These older patients are getting this regimen without a proteasome inhibitor. And of course, now they haven't even got second-line therapy, but they get on average, they get to 5 years just from the first treatment, and really makes your point about 10 years and more being, you know, a reasonable goal for a lot of these patients. And now I'm curious too, if you could, what this woman's lifestyle is like. Does she have a family? What does she like to do? What's her quality of life?
Yeah, she actually moved to the Atlanta area to be near her daughter. And, you know, she was still very active. You know, she would bring her knitting with her to clinic, and she had grandchildren in town. And, you know, she tolerated treatment. She came, got her treatment. It gets to a once a month, you know, with daratumumab. And so, you know, sees us briefly and then, you know, gets treatment and is living her life.
What kind of work did she do in the past? And what was her attitude about information? Was she asking a lot of questions, looking things up, or just asking you what to do?
No, you know, I find that myeloma patients ask a lot of questions, and that's good, right? They're pretty educated. She was a retired school teacher, and So she was used to information, right, and wanting information. And, and she's an active member of the local support group.
Really?
Yes. You know, so, and still does that.
It's interesting. It's kind of in a way now with all our electronic abilities to communicate like we are right now, you kind of maybe don't necessarily think about these live. I mean, I don't even know. Maybe the support groups are Zoom too, for all I know. But What do you think people get out of it? What do you think they get out of the support groups? I mean, I guess the obvious would be, you know, support and encouragement. But any specific things that you think they get out of that?
I think there's a psychosocial support that they get in hearing somebody else's case or seeing somebody that's doing really well. Now, we do get a lot of questions because it'll be like, well, so-and-so's on this treatment. Why is my treatment different? And, you know, you have that conversation that everybody's different and how you get treated, but they do Zoom as well since COVID. So they do a little bit of a hybrid there, but I think, you know, they become friends with each other and they have sessions that focus on the caregivers, for instance. And I think that's nice for the families as well.
It's great that this lady is doing so well. Just out of curiosity, if, you know, she were to have disease progression at some point, I guess one of the things you would think probably she's not going to be a candidate for CAR T, although I would ask if that would be a possibility, because I know there are people who are not eligible for transplant that could go to CAR T. But really, in particular, how you think she would be a candidate for a bispecific? Because that seems to be much more tolerable. Seems like somebody like that could probably handle it. What do you think?
I think so. We have taken patients as 82, 83 to CAR T, but it really depends on their cardiac status too. That particular patient had AFib and, you know, a little bit older now. So probably think about a bispecific. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I was mentioning, I kept hearing about cases from Zager of patients going from trial to trial. I got to tell you that I've been doing patient interviews ever since the pandemic, really. And one of my favorite examples of that was I did a video with a patient, a man who'd been on the bispecific teclistamab, mm-hmm. which, of course, is one of the bispecifics out there. He'd been on it for a year and a half. Very smooth, almost no toxicity, complete remission, doing great. And the day that I interviewed him was the day it was approved.
Yeah, that's great.
So he had been on it for a year and a half before mm-hmm. it got out, and he'd been enjoying the benefit of it. And again, I keep thinking of all your patients I've heard about through Sagar with just that same story. They went to one trial, then they go to something else, and then they their history is the history of the evolution of treatment, but, you know, just a different story nowadays with trials, you know, the real opportunity, not just to help future patients, but current ones. All right. Well, now we have a much younger patient, 62-year-old. Now we're getting into the arena of transplant eligibility. I don't know where this patient was or not, but 62, mm-hmm. that would be one thing I'd be thinking about if he was going to be showing up in clinic. But what happened with him?
Absolutely. So he came in, he did have a lot of bone disease. So it was progressive back pain. And, you know, on workup, he had a lot of compression fractures. So he's somebody, you know, he was a little bit hypercalcemic as well with that, and significant pain issues at that point. So he had a kyphoplasty. He was standard risk disease, though. We did induction with DARA-RVD for him. Did four cycles, did stem cell collection, and took him to transplant. And he achieved a complete CR, a serum CR, MRD negative, and just is on single agent lenalidomide maintenance now. And, you know, it took us a while to get him through the pain issues with help from, you know, other colleagues, the orthopedics and that, but he's off of all pain medicine now and pretty much back to his normal life. The last time I saw him, he had just come back from two European trips and then was going to Alaska. So, I mean, he's traveling, he feels great, and he's doing really well. And, you know, he had some residual neuropathy after transplant. So we delayed starting his lenalidomide just a little bit, but he's on it doing well.
So, you know, it's natural when we ask people to present cases, we often hear success stories. And I guess it's important to say that not every patient does as well as the two people you presented here, but a lot of them do. And I mm-hmm. think the fact that this is not a, you know, very unusual story for either one of these patients is noteworthy. What kind of work has he done? Is he still working? Family? What's his life like?
Yeah, he's married. He has children that are out of state, grown children and grandchildren. He is working. He's in a distribution business. And so back to kind of self-employed. Back to normal work, back to golfing, which with the back issues like he had, patients don't always get back to some of their prior activities. So, but it took him a little bit of time to get there.
So, as you know, one of our themes over the years is, when was the last time somebody said to you, why are you in oncology? Isn't it depressing? And, you know, I love hearing what people have to say about that, particularly, you know, people just entering the field. But, you know, these two cases, again, are real good examples. And we certainly, I know you and everybody sees situations that are very, very difficult. But you also see mm-hmm. situations where people really go through transformation and they're not just becoming, you know, treated well for their disease or even cured, but maybe even transformed at a deeper level. Here you have a young man, 62 years old, presents with what I would call disseminated cancer, right? And not like it's like a single lesion we can take out. And he's in severe pain. I can imagine his mental state once he got the diagnosis. And I'm curious what you've seen in him and other patients when they go through things they never thought they could get through, how it affects them, and also how it affects you to see that.
Mm-hmm. I think this one was a little more challenging in how he felt because he just struggled with the how this happened to me aspect, right? I was living my normal life, doing my normal business. I had some back pain and then bam, you know, I'm in here and, you know, I've lost height in my spine and, you know, I've had kyphoplasties and then I'm told I have this cancer I've never heard of. And so I think especially early on, we spend a lot of time helping support our patients through that. And you're right. The first two cases, patients have done very well. You know, we see all aspects of it. Not everybody does as well, though. Up front, they typically do a little bit better because our treatment regimens are better. But the high-risk patient still can be very challenging. But you get to know your patients, and you see them so frequently. So, you know, you're part of getting them to where they need to be and getting them over this piece of it. And so I think that's where we come in and we just spend so much time with them. But, you know, I think for this gentleman, when he looks back to where he was, you know, 8 months ago, he can look and say, you're right, I am so much better. And I'm now able to do these things again. And that is our goal for patients. You know, there's a lot of work to do up front to get you to a place that you can get back to what you feel like is normal activity for you, even if you don't go back to what you consider a normal baseline.
Another theme that we've talked about over the years at ONS is what we call the bond that heals, which is the idea that the relationship that you have with a patient is a special benefit to them that goes beyond the treatment, the anti-tumor strategy you're using, that they value, that they benefit by the connection they have with you. Any thoughts about how that played out in, for example, these two patients and what you see? Do you feel that as you practice?
Yeah, I think that it's very important to have a connection with your patient. And, you know, I'm not the only advanced practice provider or nurse in our practice. And, you know, we try not to have patients see somebody different every time they come because having that connection with them is really important because we do a teamwork approach to taking care of our patients with our physicians. So, you know, Dr. Loniel isn't able to see every patient all the time. And it's important for the patient to have a good relationship with the people that are taking care of them. And sometimes it's not a good fit and you've got to find that right fit. Because that's, you know, they're depending on our expertise, they're depending on us to help manage their side effects and to give them the information, right? And it's an amazing relationship and we're very fortunate to have to do what we do. I think we're drawn to oncology for a reason. You know, we all find our specialties, but it's a very special field to practice in.
And again, another theme we've had over the years in oncology is thinking about, again, nurses who are new to oncology, who are, you know, trying to understand what's going on and, you know, seeing things that maybe they hadn't ever seen before in terms of patients suffering and families dealing with really difficult issues. And the challenge of avoiding burnout and, you know, taking care of yourself, your own self-health. You know, for one of the things we've done at ONS a number of times is when we introduce the faculty, we have them show pictures of what they do to get away from work. Because one of the advice we kept getting all the time was, you got to get away from it. But I'm just sort of curious if you have any observations on burnout and any advice to people just starting the field.
Yeah, I think when you're starting out, you do also have to figure out those boundaries for yourself. You do have to take downtime, do those things that you enjoy, spend time with your family. If you like to travel, you still need to do all those things and count on your team members to get you through. You know, a lot of nursing and advanced practice have gone to residencies or fellowships to bring new people into oncology. And I think that's helpful as well to give them resources. But I think especially at your bigger centers, we have a lot of resources available to us, you know, people to talk to, you know, when you need to about, you know, your patients or somebody that didn't do well. You know, we do still lose patients. So, you know, it's important, I think, for those of us that are more experienced too, to help mentor our new colleagues that have joined oncology.
Did you see something about a fellowship?
Yeah, we have advanced practice fellowships. So for nurse practitioners and physician assistants, that they do like a 1 year oncology rotation through all the specialties. And our nurses have residency programs. So bringing new nurses into oncology, and they rotate through the different specialties. You know, so they're learning about all of oncology, and it's not something just we do, but I think that's more available throughout, especially at your academic centers. It's a really good way to bring new practitioners and nurses into oncology.
One final issue I wanted to mention to you, and this came out a lot when I was talking to the patients with breast cancer, which is complementary strategies. Everything from nutrition to meditation, you know, alternative, you know, massage therapy, acupuncture, anything. You mentioned kyphoplasty before, which of course is a little bit more medical, but what kind of advice I'm sure people ask you, what should I eat? What do I do about exercise? Any specific strategies you think are helpful, particularly in myeloma?
Yeah, I think it's important for myeloma patients to move. You know, they may not be able to exercise in a way that they used to, but movement's essential. If you can just get out and walk, it's so beneficial for you. I do refer a lot of patients for acupuncture, especially patients who have neuropathy. We're very fortunate at our center. We have an integrative oncology practice. So they specialize in acupuncture, in vitamins, those things that you can take, massage, you know, physical therapy for a lot of patients is very beneficial. And we have nutritionists as well. So yes, get a lot of questions about, can I eat this? Can I eat that? Or can I have a drink? Those kind of things. And, you know, we tend to do things in moderation, but definitely we get the advice of our nutritionist as well with patients, especially if they're having issues or diarrhea related to lenalidomide, those kind of things. There's help.
I was just sort of, again, flashing a little bit on Sagar. And one of the things I was kind of thinking about him is he has like a little bit more of a sense of humor than most oncologists. I was sort of wondering whether you do also, and where that kind of fits into your relationship and your clinic.
Yes. You know, we're close to the same age. I'm a little older than he is, but we both enjoy movies. And I think we have a similar sense of humor that's a little bit dry. Our younger colleagues in our clinic don't always get it. So, but yes, we bounce things off of each other. I think humor in what we do is very important as well. So yes, I think that's very helpful. And Sagar and I have worked well together for these years, and, you know, so it's been a good partnership.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Ms. Gleason, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Nursing Update.